Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, where you will get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside of legal nurse consulting. They will share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with 30 years experience. So, join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's Pat.
This is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast, and I have the pleasure of bringing to you Fran Ho, who I've met a number of years ago and used her as an expert witness on some of the cases that my legal nurse consulting company had. Fran is an advanced practice nurse who specializes in palliative care. She provides services in acute care settings and also online. Fran, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Pat. I'm excited to be here.
One of the big topics that people focus on these days, Fran, is the whole opioid crisis epidemic and how that impacts care that we are delivering to patients. When you are involved in looking at some of the pain management issues that come to your attention, does the issue of getting too much opioids ever come up in your practice?
Well, I first want to, just make a quick comment on the opioid epidemic. I mean, we had an opioid epidemic before we had COVID. And now with COVID, the statistics are just even more staggering that we have more opioid deaths and more opioid overdoses than we did even before. So, COVID has not made it any better and really made it a lot worse. Mm-hmm. I think we see more underdosing than we see overdosing. I just read an article today in preparing for today from the American Association for Pain Management Nursing, ASPMN, has a brand new hot off the press physician statement on respiratory depression and assessing for respiratory depression in with use of opiates and who we should be especially careful to look for. So one of the things that they said is that 50% of the patients that are in the hospital will receive an opiate. And of that 50%, 0.003 to 4.2% will have an adverse reaction. And for those that have an adverse reaction, it will increase the length of stay. It will increase the cost of the care. It will put them more at risk to get other side effects or episodes of, negative things happening to them. So, I think that we definitely do have, some patients that get more medicine than they should. But we also have the problem of people getting a lot less medicines than they should.
And in our world in legal nurse consulting, the under-medicated patients are not nearly as prominent as the over-medicated ones.
Right.
Are there risk factors that you've run into in terms of who is particularly at concern for getting too much medication?
Absolutely. I mean, we should really, as nurses, we know who we should be assessing for. Patients that are opiate naive are our biggest risk. So people that have never had an opiate before, they're most likely to have a reaction. Patients that we start long-acting opiates on off the bat, especially if they're opiate naive, those patients can run into problems. Patients with renal failure, depending on the drug that we're giving, morphine is one of the opiates that's metabolized by the kidneys. So that if patients are in renal failure and we give them morphine, they could be more susceptible to have an overdose than if we gave them an equal dose of oxycodone, for example, because morphine is metabolized by the kidneys. And when morphine breaks down and the kidneys can't break it down, then those levels rise and therefore patients can get sedated and have respiratory depression. So patients with renal failure, patients that are opiate naive, patients that are on long actings. You know, this article that I read today from ASPMN also said that patients with diabetes and CHF are also in a risk factor group. Patients with obesity that have sleep apnea, and then we give them opiates, they also are at risk to have an opiate overdose. So we just need to really, you know, be watching carefully. First is knowing what patients are going to be more likely to have a problem, and then assessing them more closely if we suspect that they fall into that group.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about the people who may have more than one risk factor. The diabetic who's in congestive heart failure, who's opiate naive, has got a triple whammy.
Exactly, exactly. You know, I mean, I always tell the joke of, you know, if you're walking into a patient's room with 2 milligrams of IV Dilaudid in a syringe and you see a sleep apnea machine at the bedside, you should probably think twice about what you're giving, because, you know, we just really need to be aware of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about what happens in the home care setting. We've just talked about the acute care setting. Are there people who are on high dose opioids at home?
Absolutely. I mean, you'd be surprised how many people are on high dose opiates at home. You know, I don't know if you're aware, there's a new ruling now that whenever we write an opioid prescription, we also need to write a Narcan prescription. Now, when that first started being talked about a couple of years ago. In Pennsylvania, it was mandated before it was in New Jersey. I know your listeners are probably from all over the country and all over the world, but I'm from New Jersey. And in New Jersey, the law was passed within a year that whenever we write a prescription for an opioid, we have to write a prescription for Narcan. And initially, when I heard this ruling, I thought to myself, if I suspect that a patient is going to overuse the drugs I'm giving them, then I shouldn't be giving them those drugs. So why would I be writing a Narcan prescription? But in looking at it a little more deeply, there are a couple of reasons. Say, for example, I have a patient with normal kidney function who's on long-acting morphine and short-acting morphine. And then for some reason, maybe, you know, they're taking too many NSAIDs, or they have a cardiac catheterization and something shuts their kidneys down. And then all of a sudden, the morphine that I'm giving them that they've been tolerant to for the past year now is suddenly too much for them. So that would be a good example of why Narcan would be needed in the home in someone who's on an opiate. Another example would be somebody comes into the house and takes your drug that's not supposed to be taking your drug, and they develop some kind of respiratory distress. That would be another example of why it would be appropriate. You know, the question is, some patients live alone. So, you know, we now have to think about instructions to give people. If you live alone, you know, and you are on chronic opiates and you have a Narcan dose in the house, you know, maybe you should have a notice on your refrigerator or on your bathroom or somewhere that says, you know, the Narcan is located in the top drawer in the kitchen, you know, so that if someone comes into your house and finds you in a state where you're not breathing, they'll know where the Narcan is.
Now I'm thinking about my next door neighbor in Florida whose husband had an implanted pump with morphine in it, and a son with a substance abuse problem. And the son came into the home and discovered that dad was on morphine and thought that was really cool. And one time, while this man's wife, who was not the mother of this young man, she went out to buy some groceries, she came back and she found crowbar marks on the doorframe from the son who was trying to break into the safe where the morphine was being kept. And he couldn't get in. He was very frustrated. Yeah. And up to that point, Fran, it never occurred to me that a child would try to steal a father's morphine supply.
That is one of that was the whole thing that they were talking about like 2 years ago, that drug overdoses are not happening from the drug dealer on the street. They're happening from your own family or people that are coming into your house. You know, there were stories of all the grandchildren that couldn't wait to come home and see grandma and grandpa because the first place they check out is their bathroom cabinet to see if there were any drugs in there. So, you know, it's very common, you know, people, if you're people that come in to do work in your house, you know, that's why they say that you should always keep it locked under a lock and key. And it was good that those people in Florida had it under lock and key. Otherwise, there could have been a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's addiction is a significant problem and people just can't help themselves. And, you know, they do things that, you know, are crazy to the rest of us sometimes, you know. Yeah. But you just have to, you know, you have to just be aware of who's at risk. Again, just like we talked about before, you know, with patients who are at risk for overdose in the hospital, there are also patients at risk for, you know, addiction in the home. You know, and part of what home care nurses should be doing is doing an assessment of the other members of the family. You know, is there anybody in this family that has a substance abuse problem? Because then you better be much more even acutely aware of how you lock up your drugs. You know, there are several opiate risk addiction tools that people can use, and we should be using them whenever we're prescribing opiates to patients as an outpatient basis, so that we make sure that, you know, if there's a risk, we identify it and that we have somebody to refer them to if they have a history, you know. And that's another big part of the problem. Everybody thinks that, you know, if somebody has a drug history or an opiate drug history, a substance use disorder history, that we can't give them pain meds. You know, I mean, we can give them pain meds, but we just have to give them a lot more carefully than we would to everybody else. You know, you might not give someone a 30-day supply. You might give them a 5-day supply. You know, you may have they have different systems that, you know, the bottles can lock and they're on a timer and you can't open the bottle until it's time. You know, so there's lots of different things out there that, you know, we can use to address that, but we definitely should be doing an addiction history on patients that we're prescribing drugs to. And if there is a history, we should be, you know, having that addressed in our care plan for them.
Mm-hmm. I also think about the signs that I've seen when I went to my doctor's office in Florida that said, we're going to give you a 3-day supply of an opioid. And the underlying text, which didn't say it this way, but just forget about asking for a renewal because that's all you're going to get, honey. That was the message that I got out of that. How does that legislation affect what you do in terms of helping people with chronic pain?
It is getting more and more difficult every single month. I have an outpatient pain practice where I see patients in the office once a month, small group of people. I've been following many of them for years. They're just people with chronic pain. And we used to have to get pre-approval for a drug. So if I'm going to start someone on a long-acting drug, I would need to do a pre-authorization for it. Now, some of the drug insurance companies are requiring 2 pre-authorizations. Mm. A pre-authorization for the drug and a pre-authorization for the dose. So if the dose is greater than, you know, 90 or 100 milligrams of morphine a day, then we have to justify why they need that much more. Then maybe they won't pay for the long acting. So then I would give the patient more short acting to try to compensate for the long acting that was taken away. And then they say, well, we won't pay for that many pills. We won't pay for 6 pills a day, 180 pills a month of a short acting because we don't allow that many. But they just took away the long acting. So now I have to make it up somewhere. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very difficult. And the patients feel it too. You know, the patients feel like they're treated like criminals. I sent a patient to a pharmacy the other day And I had forgotten to put the date on the prescription. And she'd been in that office that day and went to the pharmacy, and the pharmacist called me. And, you know, when the girl walked in, she innocently put today's date on the prescription. She had 4 or 5 prescriptions from me, and that one of them didn't have the date on it. So she just wrote the date on, just like she would write her birthday on. Well, the pharmacist refused to fill the prescription because she had altered it by putting the date on. So I said, the patient called me. I said, well, have the pharmacist call me. I'll verify that you just left the office an hour ago. Mm-hmm. The pharmacist said to me, I am doing her a favor by filling this prescription because she usually goes to another pharmacy, but that other pharmacy didn't have some of the other drugs that we had put her on. So that's why she went to this one. And I said to the pharmacist, you are not doing her a favor by giving her her prescription. You are the pharmacy. And she is a client coming to get her medicine, which is what your job is to do. And the pharmacist made the patient come back to my office and get another prescription with the date on. And I'm not saying it was right for the patient to put the date on. I'm not saying that. The pharmacist could have called me and written the date in. You know, it wasn't such a big deal, but they're making a big deal of everything, you know. And we need to. We have an opioid epidemic. We have people that are misusing. So we need to be careful. I'm not saying we don't. But I'm saying there are also legitimate patients out there that have pain, that need their pain treated and shouldn't be treated like criminals because they're bringing an opioid prescription to the pharmacy. And a lot of my patients feel that way.
Can you give us some insight into the prescription monitoring programs, prescription drug monitoring program, and how that impacts the management of pain?
You know, this, I think, was one of the best things that ever happened. I love the PDMP. I use it daily. It does not take long to use. Everybody should be using it. Everybody. I mean, everybody. I used to work for an anesthesia department. And when we had patients coming in for surgery, you know, it was routine that we would check the patient's PDMP before they came in. You never know what you're going to find there. Mm-hmm. And I want to just say why I love it. I love it for many reasons. I love it because it gives me the name of the provider who provided for them before. So very often, if I have a suspicion about a patient, I just want to double check, I can call the provider that they used to go to and say, you know, the patient's coming to me now. Have you had any problems with urine drug screens clean? You know, what were your, you know, what was going on with, you know, with this patient? So that's a good thing. It allows me to see when the last time the prescription was filled. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's crazy what people do. I had a patient in long-term care once. I was working in the nursing homes, and a patient was going home and needed a prescription to go home on the medicine she had been getting here in the nursing home. She'd been in the nursing home for probably 2.5 months. So my partner usually covered that nursing home. So it was a patient I didn't know. So I went in to give the patient her discharge meds, and I looked her up in the PMP just because I wanted to see what was she on at home 2 months ago and what were we giving her now and was there that much of a difference? Well, sure enough, when I looked up the PMP, I found out that a month's worth of prescriptions were filled 5 days ago. The same two prescriptions that I was going to be sending this patient home on.
Right.
So I went into the room. So first I called. Now I knew who the doctor was who prescribed them. So I called the doctor. I'm like, did you write a prescription for Mrs. Jones, who you haven't seen in 2 months, who's been in the nursing home for her prescriptions this week? And he said, oh, yes, her daughter came in and said she needed them. So then I called the pharmacy, because now we also know who the pharmacy is. And I said, did you dispense these prescriptions to, you know, this patient's daughter? They said, yes, we did. She comes every month for her patient, her mother's prescriptions. So I walked into the patient's room and I said, you do not need a prescription for me. I said, your daughter already picked up your prescriptions. Now, perhaps the daughter was worried that her mother wouldn't get her scripts when she left the nursing home and just wanted to make sure she got them. Why that was not communicated to the patient and to me, I don't know. But if I had not checked, she would now have gotten, you know, a second prescription for those meds. you know, and she probably wouldn't have been able to fill them at that time, but she may have fallen in a window that she could have gotten them in another 30 days or 28 days using my prescription, you know. So it's the PMP is an excellent source of information. We can use it to, we can also look at trends, you know. I'm always about trending. Are we using more or are we using less? So you can look back over a year or 2 years and you can see, you know, how much have they been increasing or have they been on the same dose the whole time? The other thing is now we can look at different states, you know. So, you know, it's always a nice idea to just peek in your surrounding states just to make sure that they're not going anywhere else. The other thing it tells you is how they paid for it. You know, sometimes patients will pay cash because they think that it won't be tracked. They think if they pay cash and don't put it through their insurance, that their insurance won't know. But that's not true because now we have the PMP. The other thing it's good for is you can tell if a patient's lying. So if I go into a room and I'm meeting a patient for the first time, and every time I go into the room, I've already checked the PMP when I'm meeting the person for the first time. So if I say to you, you know, tell me what you take at home for your pain, and they tell me something different than I got on the PMP, then I know, you know, they're not being upfront with me and we need to clear that up right away. Mm-hmm. So there's just many, many ways we can use the PMP.
I think about how I used to go through prescription records and I would find out that the patient was going to Walgreens and getting a prescription filled and going to CVS and getting a prescription filled and going to Rite Aid and getting a prescription filled. And often the physicians involved, usually there was more than one, wasn't aware that anyone else was prescribing for that patient. Mm-hmm. Does this get resolved with the system that you're describing?
Pretty much. We can track everywhere they're going and where they're getting it from. Mm-hmm. The other thing that is helpful, which is happening more now than ever happened before, is the insurance companies are now sending you letters. So if the insurance company identifies that there are several providers, they will send you a letter with a copy of the record and say, you are one of the providers. We just wanted to make you aware that there are some discrepancies and you may, be aware that there are discrepancies. Now, oftentimes for me, so if I've taken care of a patient in the nursing home and now they go out and their regular provider is taking care of them, I may not be following them anymore. Or the other way around, if they were in a nursing home getting taken care of by Dr. Jones and now they're outpatient and they're coming to me, it may be, it may be totally appropriate. But the insurance companies are on top of it too, and they're sending you out reminders.
That sounds like there's some safeguards in place.
Absolutely. Yes, there should be.
So, yeah. I remember when I found patterns like that of always making it a point of telling the attorney, there's a concern here that needs to be investigated. If I was helping the plaintiff attorney, I would raise the question of whether there was drug seeking, was there indeed pain, was this spilling over to becoming a behavioral issue. You know, the attorneys were always interested in knowing that because they knew that the defense side could be monitoring those prescription records and coming up with the same conclusions, and that would impact the litigation.
Right, exactly.
You know, another area of how we get involved with attorneys, and we touched on it in the beginning, we're circling back to the question of getting too many doses of medications, too much Dilaudid combined with other drugs that potentiate the opioids, or the patient with a PCA pump who's getting a lot of medication without adequate monitoring. Have you run into that in your clinical practice as an issue in acute care?
Yeah, you know, I used to run a pain service. So BCAs were something we used all the time and I was very comfortable with. In some facilities, they don't use PCAs a lot. And so it's not as easy. I had a situation once where a woman was on a PCA at home. She was a cancer patient on a PCA at home. And she came to the hospital and the hospital decided to just let her use her own PCA. They didn't switch it out for our PCA. I think the physician told them he didn't want them to switch it out. He wanted them to use the same one. So now she's in the hospital 4 days and now it's time. I look at the thing and I see it's going to run out. So I call her son and say, you know, if you've got another cartridge from home, you have to bring it. Well, then everybody was up in arms because their nurses can't be touching that pump. I said, well, your nurses have been monitoring this pump for 5 days. This pump should never have been allowed to stay here because no one knows how to use it and no one's trained how to use it. And if something happens, you don't have any leg to stand on that your people knew how to work this pump. So I think that's something that you can run into that can happen. The other thing is thinking about the way we deliver drugs via the PCA pump. There are two ways you can deliver drugs via PCA pump. There's a basal rate, which is a continuous rate that the patient gets all the time. And then there's a PCA rate where the patient just clicks the button and they get the rate only when they press. And there's a combination of both. So the way I was trained was that you don't ever want to use a basal rate on someone who wasn't on a lot of opiates before. So if I have someone who's on OxyContin or MS-Contin at home, I can convert the amount of drug they were taking at home and replace it with a basal PCA dose. But if they're not opiate tolerant and on a long acting at home, you got to be really careful when you use a basal rate, a continuous dose in what you're giving them, because that could be too much. Mm-hmm. So I think the big issues with PCA is documentation. I think that sometimes people forget that PCA is a medication just like any other drug we give. And just like the five rights of drugs apply to when I'm giving a pill, the same is true if I'm giving a continuous PCA dose. And I still need to be documenting at the end of shift how much drug that patient used. I still should be looking at it and saying, okay, if the patient pressed 400 times, and only got 50 doses, am I underdosing the patient? Or is the patient anxious? Or does he not know how to use the machine? Do I need to educate him? Or do I need to give him more medicine? But I think sometimes the PCA is just forgotten as it'll go on its own and there's really not much intervention needed. But PCA is no different than giving pain meds any other way. We need to assess their pain. We need to assess how much drug they're using. We need to assess if they're getting relief from the drug that we're using and then adjust as needed. And I think that sometimes because in some places they're not using them so frequently, you know, that may be a little bit overlooked.
And it's a potent drug being delivered in a potent way.
Exactly. It's one of those, what do you call it? You probably know the words. I don't remember. It's like high risk, high something, like when they look at things that are problematic. If it's a high risk thing that you're using all the time, you know, you're more likely that there's going to be a problem with it. And that's the problem that can happen with this. You are giving intravenous drug of a very potent drug.
I think the things that, and I'm pulling out of my dusty brain, the things that are high risk, but you do infrequently, are the ones where you have a huge potential for an injury, as opposed to high frequency and high risk. Presumably, the staff know the system. They know how to document it. They know how to load the pump appropriately. They know what to do to assess. They know how to use Narcan or to withhold the basal rate if it appears that's necessary. Those are the nuances with that system.
Absolutely. That's what I was thinking of. You're absolutely right.
Fran, how can our listener find out more about you and the services that you offer?
Well, they can go to my website, which is www.palliativerx.net. We also have two Facebook groups going. I have a Facebook group for patients with serious illness, and it's called CHF, COPD, Cancer and Dementia Education and Support. And then we also have the business page, which gives some information for professionals on palliative care, and that's just called Palliative RX on the Facebook pages.
Very nice. Thank you.
You're
any
welcome.
Parting words or advice for the legal nurse consultant who has been paying attention to what you've been saying for the last 30 minutes?
I just think that being aware of patients that are underdosed is also important as people that are overdosed. Because I think when we underdose people, we increase suffering significantly. And I think we really need to be aware of that. I'm going to a webinar. I just signed up for a webinar today on wrongful life suits. You know, people that we keep alive and prolong suffering when we shouldn't be, and we keep doing things that we shouldn't do, you know, and when we have people that we prolong suffering on because we cookie cutter our treatment plan, and we give everybody the same 1 milligram of morphine IV that walks into the hospital, whether they were on 100 mics of Duragesic patch, you know, 200 milligrams of oxycodone a day or zero, everybody gets the same 1 or 2 milligrams of morphine IV. And I think we also need to be careful of when we discharge patients, we need to make sure that there's a discharge plan in place as to how they're going to get the opiates that they were on when they were in the hospital. Sometimes it happens when, you know, that doesn't happen. And that's another big problem when patients go home and now they don't have the medicine that we're keeping them comfortable in the hospital and they have nothing. And that's a significant problem. And also being aware of the patient with the risk of addiction. Just because they have a history of substance use disorder doesn't mean that we're not going to treat them for pain. And that's when you need to call in a pain service that can really help you figure that out. We had a guy when I was at Overlook, we had a guy who had a total shoulder replacement, who had a history of substance use disorder and was on methadone and did not want any narcotics for his total shoulder replacement. And we gave him IV Tylenol around the clock. We gave him, you know, gabapentin for nerve pain. We had a nerve block that we normally took out after 3 days, but we left in for 6 days and sent him home with it so that he wouldn't, and he didn't need to use any opiates, and we were able to keep him comfortable. We used anti-inflammatories. We used everything we had that was a non-opiate, and we were able to keep him comfortable. And that's important. It's important that patients feel heard when they tell you they have pain and you do nothing. They need to feel heard. And when they tell you they have a history of, when they trust you enough to tell you they have a history of addiction, you need to monitor their pain appropriately. So those are my pearls.
All right. Thank you, Fran. And thank you to you who's been listening to me talk with Fran Ho, a registered nurse, a clinical specialist, a palliative care expert who manages acute pain and chronic pain in an online business coupled with visiting patients in acute care and helping doctors and nurses manage the pain of their patients better. Be sure to come back next week. We'll have a new topic, new speaker. Tell other legal nurse consultants about Legal Nurse Podcast. We are now recording programs in our 5th year of production, and we love to hear from you. If you have an idea of a topic or a speaker you'd like to have included in the show, please contact me at pateyer@legalnursebusiness.com. Thanks very much. This is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. I have just finished a podcast with Toby Geis. Toby, let's tell our listener or the person watching this on our YouTube channel, what are some of the key things that we covered in your podcast?
We talked about my struggle with bulimia for 26 years and how I overcame that. We talked about what are potential root causes beneath eating disorders and addictions in general. And we talked about some strategies on how to heal and what you can do right now to start to shift this pattern.
Thank you, Toby. If you or somebody you know has an eating disorder, you're going to be sure to want to hear Toby or watch her video as she shares the strategies and her own story of overcoming something that kept her in its grip for many, many years. Be sure to get Toby Geis's podcast on Legal Nurse Podcast.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Join our community to get notified of each new episode and to receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. We appreciate you and your interest.